I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Fisker Automotive is on the verge of bankruptcy. Its founder has left. It has missed loan payments. Employees have been laid off. Production of its fancy Karma has been put on hold. There have been battery problems, and Consumer Reports was not impressed. A few years ago, there were high hopes for Fisker's plug-in hybrid electric car design. Today on Radio Times, we're checking in on the state of electric and hybrid electric vehicles, beginning with John Volker to talk about Fisker Automotive. He's editor of GreenCarReports.com. And John Volker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
So let's roll back the clock a couple of years. What was Fisker Automotive promising? What was innovative about their original designs?
Fisker promised what was essentially a green luxury car. And anyone who's seen a Fisker will know it's a stunning design. It's very low. It's very swoopy four-door sedan. I drove one in New York City, and it's one of the very few cars I've ever driven that makes jaded construction workers do a complete 180 and follow it down the street.
Lucky you.
That said, what Fisker did mechanically was to give it about 30-odd miles of electric range and then have an engine that switches on to power the car on gasoline thereafter. Same system as used in the Chevy Volt. The problem really with the Fisker was that it's very expensive. It's $106,000. It was a startup car maker. They missed numerous deadlines, and the car that finally struggled into production wasn't very well built and turned out to be the least efficient electric car sold in the U.S. And whether there's a market for luxury electric cars is a little debatable, although the other startup, Tesla Motors in Silicon Valley, is actually doing somewhat better than everybody else expected. But Fisker's likely failure gets all the headlines right now.
Indeed. But I do want to talk about the Tesla. But there, it seems that there were battery problems. They had a supplier that went out of business. There were some batteries that caught fire as well. I also read that there were something like 200, Karmas that got flooded out when Sandy rolled in last fall.
Yes. Fisker had a combination of quality problems, a problem with its battery supplier, which was A123 Systems, itself a startup about 10 years ago and a very promising one, and just plain bad luck. So a list of the major Fisker problems, although not complete, includes a fan in the engine compartment that overheated, caught fire, and in a couple of cases set fire to the car.
Oh, geez.
A production problem in a new Michigan lithium-ion cell fabrication plant owned by A123, which meant that they had to recall several hundred batteries they had sent to Fisker and replace them because there were some defective cells, which sent A123 into bankruptcy, as well as obviously causing huge problems for Fisker. Consumer Reports got a Fisker, and it actually simply died on the middle of their test track.
Oh, dear.
Not a favorable thing.
Indeed.
And then there was Hurricane Sandy. They actually had over 300 cars waiting on a dock in Newark for replacement parts. Hurricane Sandy came in, swamped all of them, and over a dozen of them actually caught fire because there's a test that car makers do called saltwater submersion, where basically you dunk the car into ocean water, leave it there for a while. When it dries out, you want to make sure that salt water hasn't shorted out anything. All the big car makers do that test. Fisker hadn't, and as a result, a number of Fiskers caught fire. So it was just bad press on top of bad press on top of bad press.
How many Fisker owners are there in the United States today? Do you know?
Fisker's never actually talked about production and sales, which is unfortunately far too common among startup automakers. Mm-hmm. But we know they've built at least 2,000. So total global sales, and the bulk of that was in the U.S. with some in Europe as well. The total global sales are probably something around 2,000 cars.
You had mentioned how, frankly, beautiful this car was. And I'm not a big car person, but I did see one. And I have to say, I thought it was gorgeous. I mean, it was kind of like if I had that kind of money, it would be such a fantasy car to have if it had worked.
Well, it's The people who bought them really love them, and as with many early adopters, they've stuck by the company through thick and thin. It's truly a striking design. Henrik Fisker, after whom the company is named, is a designer who's created Aston Martins, BMWs, and other luxury cars. And, you know, he knows how to make truly striking cars.
Yeah.
Some of the design aspects of the car compromised its functionality. It's a very big car. It has the footprint of a BMW 7 Series, but the EPA actually defines it as a subcompact inside because there's so little room.
And what was it like to drive? Just curious.
It's a big, heavy car. It weighs the better part of 3 tons. It's quiet and smooth under electric power and in sport mode, which is both electric and the engine. It's fairly fast. It's got enormous wheels, so the ride is stiff, but it's not the kind of car you throw through turns. It's more of a grand touring car, if you like.
Now,
when it ran, I did have the problem, unfortunately, that during a test drive, the dash went dark. Just the entire dash, which is essentially a liquid crystal or a TV display, essentially, just went dark. Mm-hmm. And the Fisker person chirped, "Oh, that's okay. Just pull over to the side, park the car, turn it off, wait 5 minutes so it goes to sleep, and then start up again. It'll be fine."
Right. It's not your cell phone, right?
This is not something you hear from GM, Volkswagen, or Toyota.
I gotcha. As I said, I do want to move on to some other designs as well. But critics of this car have said this is the Solyndra of the electric car. Is that a fair charge, do you think?
I can argue both sides of that. Here's the issue. The U.S. government under President Bush started a program called Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing under the Department of Energy. And the goal was to help companies make the jump to making more efficient automobiles, to reduce oil usage, reduce emissions, et cetera, et cetera. That program was actually funded, and then the Obama administration's Department of Energy made the awards. If you're going to give government money to small startup companies, and the awards went to a mix of companies. Ford actually got by far the bulk of it. Ford got about $6 billion. Nissan got $1.5 billion as well. The amounts of money that went to Fisker and Tesla were much smaller, but those are startup companies with venture funding, and some of them are not going to make it, similar to Solyndra. People who defend the various government funding programs point out that the vast majority of companies that got money do, in fact, still exist, and they're doing essentially what they were funded to do. But there is a difference between venture capitalists who expect to lose chunks of their money but make it back and more with one big hit out of, say, every 10 companies, and the government, which may not actually have the stomach to say, yep, some of this money is going to go to companies that will fail, because it's taxpayer money, and that's different.
Are there things, though, that can be learned from failure when it comes to trying to create a new automotive design?
Yes. Execution is 98% of the battle. And in this case, Fisker got hammered both by its own lateness and its not up to standard quality, and by the same thing at its battery supplier. And those two together, I mean, it's arguable if Fisker's had not caught fire, if their batteries had not been recalled, etc., it's arguable whether Fisker would have been a success, but I think the company might still be operating and working assiduously to sell its cars right now, as Tesla is. Tesla has largely not had those kinds of quality issues.
In fact, I was reading that Tesla is going to repay its government loan early. Does that tell us some good news about Tesla and its future?
It's a good PR move, if nothing else. They have not yet started to do so, actually, but they have said they are going to. And Tesla, at the moment, has done something that I think a lot of us in the auto industry didn't expect they were going to be able to do. They've produced not just a viable vehicle, but a really striking vehicle. So good that it's won a number of Car of the Year awards, which has never in history happened to a startup car maker's car before.
And this is an electric car, yes?
Yes. The Tesla Model S is an all-electric, or we say battery electric, luxury sports sedan. there are a couple of different options. You can have two different size battery packs for an EPA rating of 208 miles or 265 miles. And the company is setting up a network of what they call supercharger stations, which are fast battery charging locations so that you can go further than that. They're putting them on interstates and sort of between city pairs that people travel a lot. It's a very ambitious company, but they are now making something like 400 or 500 cars a week. Wow. They have a backlog of something like 10,000 orders that they're delivering against, and their owners are rabidly enthusiastic. And I will say, it is the car of the year in Silicon Valley. They are all over the valley. You see two or three of them at stoplights sometimes.
Well, they have a lot of money out there.
But, and they love new things.
And they do
they
like new things.
They are less averse to, oh, my God, I don't know, that might not work.
Yeah, they're more willing to take a chance. What about for the rest of us? As you look at electric automobiles, what do you see as the future for people of more modest means?
They will come. Electric cars are still definitely pricier than a vehicle of the same size and capacity that's run by a gasoline engine, which has about a 100-year head start. But the price of batteries comes down a few percentage points each year, and actually gasoline cars are going to get considerably more expensive between now and 2025 to meet the new gas mileage requirements that were enacted by the EPA. There's an estimate from the EPA itself that says that gas cars are going to be about $3,000 more expensive between now and 2025 in real dollars. Hmm. So if you have electric cars getting cheaper a little bit every year and gasoline cars getting more expensive, at some point the difference won't be so great. And as more people start to have plug-in cars, maybe someone on your cul-de-sac or on your block has one, and you sort of talk to them about it, maybe they let you drive it, they become a little more familiar, as hybrids have over the past decade or so. People are less worried about them. And then electric cars kick in with two really good selling points. The first one is that it costs a third to a fifth as much per mile to run on grid power. Electricity is cheap, and electric cars are very efficient. So it's the equivalent of getting, essentially, driving a mile for maybe 4 or 5 cents of gasoline. You know, very, very, very inexpensive. That works out to maybe 80 cents per gallon gasoline. The second one is that electric cars are fun to drive. Electric motors generate their power, their torque, from zero, which means they're punchy off the line at stoplights, which American drivers really love.
Yes.
They're smooth and quiet because there's no gear shifting. They don't have transmissions. And they simply run smoothly and quietly. You hear wind noises and things that you never hear in a gasoline car. Well, now, this is going to be a slow ramp.
Well, you know what, John Volker, only because they're playing my song, we do have to say goodbye to you, but I do appreciate the fact that you joined us getting this conversation started. He's editor of GreenCarReports.com. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday, May 1st from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
I'm Marty Moscowane with some facts and figures about the on-air membership campaigns here at WHYY. We do them 3 times a year. That's about 1% of our total broadcasting time. And we do this to raise a bit more than half of the funds we need to pay for the programs that you enjoy. We ask you to decide the value of this news and information service and then to make a phone call at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. And what do you get for your pledge of support? The knowledge that your investment is returned to you every day when you turn on your radio or log on to our websites. We're talking about in-depth news and analysis, lively conversation, some humor, and many ways to be connected to us. That includes Radio Times, Morning Edition, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, to name just a few of the programs. Today on the show, a roundup of Pennsylvania politics with two veteran journalists and some good news, bad news about the state of electric cars. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just said a hasty goodbye to our guest, John Volker, and we were talking about Fisker and electric cars, Tesla as well. And electric vehicles are a small but growing sector of the automotive market. While Fisker's problems could hurt the reputation of electric cars and hybrids, better battery technology and several popular models are positive signs for the industry. And in this segment, we want to focus on consumers and what they are looking for. And if that is you, we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Our second of three guests in this hour joins us, Tom Turrentine, director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center, and that's at UC Davis Institute of Transportation Studies, all the way out there in California. And Tom Turrentine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much, Marty.
I know. Nice to have you here. I know John Volker was talking about Fisker and Tesla and some of these other car designs. You were listening in. Any thoughts about what he said?
Well, we do a lot of testing with consumers of these vehicles over the last 20 years, some demonstrations. And many of the things he's talked about do ring true, especially the response to electric drive. I think that's what drew my attention to electric drive. We look at a range of alternative vehicles in our research, have focused in the last few years on electric. But the response to the way the vehicle drives was the thing that drew me to interest, because it's the one thing consumers responded very positively to this vehicle in that area. Of course, we do face issues around having, you know, household people who don't live in households where they can put a charger in their driveway, or they're in an apartment. There are some limitations here, as well as the limited range of some of the electric vehicle designs. So there are barriers, but there's also some very strong positive signals for consumers as well.
And just underscoring what you and John were saying, which is that these cars, or at least consumers, tell you that these cars are fun to drive.
Yeah, that's a strong one. That keeps coming back at from almost every test that I've been involved in consumer research. People respond. They do like how this vehicle, it seems to have almost a luxury, and I think that's why some luxury makers are interested in it. It's punchy. It's very smooth. It's quiet, so it fits in with sound systems and luxury vehicles. And that's why luxury makers often get interested in this vehicle design.
Would it be fair to say, first adopters, this is what they do. They like new technology. They're willing to take a little bit of risk for what they hope is a good return. Are we beyond that now? Are we ready to see electric cars and electric hybrids as a more regular choice for the regular consumer?
I think we're probably getting close. I always like to point out that if we remember hybrids vehicles coming out in the United States in the year 2000, there was what we call a first-generation design of that vehicle. The Prius looked really different between 2000 and 2004. There was about 4 years there of people driving around a vehicle that wasn't state of the art necessarily, but it was something brand new, and innovators were very interested. And then 2004, they redesigned that vehicle radically, and they had learned a lot in 4 years. So that second generation design was very, very sophisticated, and the inflection in the market was easy to notice for those of us who watched the markets. And the number of people, the rollout from Toyota was much greater. The interest from the public was much greater. The way the vehicle worked was a huge improvement over the Curious. And even a third-generation design in 2009-10 sort of cemented that further. And so we'll be looking for, and I think that's the point probably. So I look for that 4 years into the market. I don't expect radical redesigns of these vehicles until about we got started. We're about 2 years into it, so in another 2 years, I expect some the major car makers to be coming out with some second generation designs, and then I'll see how those neighbors and like John talked about, and that's the way we see it. I'm an anthropologist, and I really pay attention to the social patterns, and seeing those neighbors paying attention to the innovators. That's when you see how the market starts to turn.
Well, and it's interesting that you're an anthropologist looking at electric vehicles and hybrids as well. I was running across this thing called range anxiety, the idea that a battery can take you so far, and then the public allegedly gets anxious about how they're going to, I guess, recharge their batteries. Is range anxiety a real thing?
Well, I'm not a great fan of that term. It's a bit medicalized. I always point out in the literature that we really don't. It's not range anxiety has not been defined in any academic work, and you know. So, in the work that we do see, you know, when somebody gets a vehicle, they usually do. Depending on who they are, they might test out the vehicle. Some people are a little more impulsive and will drive it right out to you know, its limits. Other people are a lot more cautious and will kind of creep up on the range of the vehicle, which could be 80 miles or 100 miles, to see how that is. They're used to a gas vehicle, might get 300 miles before they have to refuel. The advantage of the electric is they can just go home. Usually they have a charger at home and fill up. So range anxiety is, you know, something that happens to drivers we see in their first, you know, week or month of driving. Something happens, and then they adapt to what the vehicle is capable of. It's not like they just kind of live for the rest of their driving life, in anxiety of what's going to happen to their vehicle. They kind of learn, like all technologies, they learn what their technology can do, and they adapt to that.
And I would think it. I mean, it would get you thinking about literally. I sound like Joe Biden, but literally, you know, how you use your car. I mean,
right.
Do you use it for lots of short-term trips? Is it a long drive to work? I would think that would be an interesting thing for people to think about.
Well, that's how we got into this. Although I'm an anthropologist, I'm actually in a transportation research group, and so we come at this problem and around electrics in particular of what are people's lifestyles. And there's, of course, a huge distribution. You know, I interview people who drive 10 miles every day to work and 10 miles back from work. They may go to a store 1 mile from home, and they have these very simple, very routine patterns. Mm-hmm. And then I talk to other people who have very unroutine patterns, and day to day don't even know really what they're going to do the next day. So the electric vehicle does beg sort of a more routine, patterned need for the battery electrics. Of course, we haven't talked about plug-in hybrids here as much, like the Fisker vehicles, like the Chevy Volt, which has a gasoline and electricity. So there are a range of vehicle products out there that fit different lifestyles. The question I've always been interested in is: Will there be a distribution of products across manufacturers from manufacturers which sort suit a range of lifestyles, so that electricity, you know, for the person who has an unpredictable lifestyle, there's a vehicle that fits them, and then for people who have a more predictable lifestyle, it's really just a perfect car for them.
Let me introduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on our conversation as well. We're getting a kind of update, a checkup on electric cars, electric hybrids, and talking with Tom Turrentine, an anthropologist. Excuse me, and director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center. That's at UC Davis Institute of Transportation Studies. Let me get Kirk from Mickleton, New Jersey, to join us. Kirk, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, how are you? Just listening to what your guest just stated, I was looking at the Toyota to purchase when the gas crunch started about 7 years ago, and because of my lifestyle with my daughter, who I had got custody of, it just wasn't enough room in that vehicle to accommodate everything that I wanted to do with the car seat, you know, going shopping to that effect. So I ended up keeping my minivan. And the other thing I wanted to bring to the conversation is I noticed that there's other companies that are producing electric motorcycles. which seems kind of unique. And I just wanted to know if he had any, if you guys had any knowledge of that, what that industry might be doing.
Well, it's interesting, Kirk. Thanks for the call to Radio Time. Tom Turrentine, have you looked at electric motorcycles?
Yeah, we do look at it. Actually, curiously, up the road from my, I live in Santa Cruz, California, and up the road is a electric dirt bike, which was a big surprise to me.
Really?
You know, so there were these, it has, because they're punchy, so on sort of short race dirt bikes, it turns out to maybe have some advantages because it has a lot of torque, so it can, it's good for hill climbing. Electric motorcycles, the big market is, of course, in Asia, and China is the interesting place where this got going. I mean, electric motorcycles have been around a while, and as John talked about, as batteries get better and better, electric motorcycles seem to make more sense. In China, what happened, almost overnight, a two-wheeler market was created when four or five large Chinese cities like Shanghai essentially banned the sale of internal combustion motorcycles, and yet they had millions of people who want these. And so an industry was birthed sort of, and during the first couple of years, and one of our students actually did his dissertation on these markets, he's had these terrible designs for two or three years, very poorly shoddy. But now that those have integrated, there were about 200 companies competing with each other, and in a very short time after, it shows how regulation can, for cities with very bad air quality, can make a big difference. We did it with Los Angeles and California. In a very short time, they came up with some very good designs. Sometimes regulations can pick the right technology, and in this case, two-wheelers seem to make a lot of sense. Chinese citizens they kind of unsnap the battery from the vehicle and carry it upstairs to their apartment where they charge it. It's not that heavy. So interesting design, and now there seems to be a proliferation of these two-wheeler, even like he's talking about, full motorcycles, not just scooters and motorbikes.
Oh, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about technology related to electric vehicles, electric hybrids and plug-ins, and again, taking calls, talking with Tom Turrentine. But would it be fair to say, I mean, we're talking about this new and evolving technology, that the internal combustion engine is on its way out? Can we say that?
I wouldn't say it too soon. I've always been surprised watching for 20 years how quickly internal combustion technology will evolve. I mean, I've always thought one of the things about electrics was they set a standard of at least from this standpoint of a tailpipe, a vehicle driving around inside one of our cities, even though it does use power, oftentimes that's from outside of the city. And so if we want a tailpipe, no tailpipe exhaust, for example, when you're parked in line at a grammar school and you're picking up kids and you have a large vehicle pumping exhaust just about at the height of a, 2 and 4 year old, it's nice to have a vehicle in our cities, which really doesn't exhaust in and around where we are breathing. So, electric seem to set the standard for that, but internal combustion, they've always responded and come up with cleaner designs. What's great about it is to have competition among these technologies. We haven't had much competition. It's been only internal combustion. So it's nice. Hopefully electrics can really give internal combustion a run for the money and make it improve.
Well, and one of the positive parts of the electricity is that it's cheap, but also the downsides, it seems to me, that a lot of electricity is powered by coal, and coal, of course, is a bad thing when it comes to the environment. Can you speak to that, Tom?
Yeah, a lot of the world's electricity is on coal. I mean, it's something, I guess, for those concerned about climate issues, coal's right now is a big problem and you want to get away from it. But it's true that a lot of countries, India and China in particular, I was just in Australia working on a project, a group of people who are trying to shift some electricity, but they're using a very dirty form of coal, brown coal in Australia, and are very dependent on that, and have a very the mining interests are very much in control of that economy, so very hard to shift off of that. But yeah, everywhere we'll move towards renewables. Lately, we've been moving quickly towards natural gas and actually had some pretty big shifts in production in the U.S. So some places like California and Washington state, the energy is pretty clean, and so it works really well for those locations. Some other locations aren't as clean, and we just are hoping that if you look down the road, this industry is going to be slow, so it doesn't matter that much right now. It's only a few vehicles, and most of them are in California or Washington state or New York state. So hopefully down the road, power will become cleaner everywhere, and it's sort of a break-even proposition with coal and gasoline right now, although, as we said, internal combustions are improving, so they'll look cleaner probably in 20 years.
I was reading about a scenario. I guess it's far into the future, excuse me, when everyone has a plug-in car, electric car. They all come home from work at the same time and plug in, and there's the grid trying to power everybody's car.
Right, right. There seems to be, from the people who work on the grid, a lot of the researchers have assured us that this isn't as big a problem. Again, there's the ramping up phase, and they had to respond to things like, which maybe some people don't support, but we certainly industry adjusted to the arrival of air conditioning in the West and South, and some areas in particular where probably in a much shorter period of time, the demand on the grid, and we're able to adjust to it. I think we of course will spread out those charges. What we see in the research is everyone actually doesn't arrive home at exactly the same time, quite like we think. And the vehicles are going to be very smart. They're very computer-like, so they will charge. They'll be interacting with the grid in 15, 20 years. I think that the fellow who's going to speak after me, Will Kempton, will be talking about this interaction with the grid. And so the cars will be communicating, and they won't all just kind of all hit it at the same time. There's a lot of smart technology that will come to bear with these vehicles.
And
the vehicles themselves are very smart with computerized systems.
Let me see if I can squeeze a caller on before we have to say goodbye. And we're almost out of time here, Linda, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great, thanks.
I have a 2012 Nissan Leaf. Been driving it for over a year, put over 1,000 miles a month on it. We charged it at home off solar. We commuted it every single day. We had a 2003 Honda Civic Hybrid. We have a 2004 Prius. We love it. We probably would never go back to not having at least one electric car.
Well, Linda, you are certainly living this stuff. Let me give Tom Turrentine just a quick response, if you don't mind, Tom. And this, a happy consumer here.
No, that's great. And we do hear lots of that, and it's wonderful to hear. We do hear this sort of progression of vehicles so that once the households make this commitment, they do find electricity very practical. We interview, we have over 20,000 people in California doing this, and we get to interview about 10 to 15% of them through surveys and in-person interviews. So we hear this a lot, that it's working quite well, especially here's a household. It's not a single vehicle. It's several vehicles, and they use them appropriately for that Leaf's probably used can be used for most trips. And then if they're going to go somewhere distant, they're going to use the Prius.
Well, Tom Turrentine, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure. Thanks.
You're welcome. From UC Davis Institute of Transportation Studies. More waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill is a proud supporter of WHYY and invites artists to deepen their personal relationship with painting and drawing on Saturday and Sunday, May 4th and 5th, with instructors Timothy Hawksworth and Layla Zeitlin. Offering individual attention to explore how we see and experience the world, this weekend workshop at Woodmere encourages artists to take risks and explore new materials. Information available at woodmereartmuseum.org or 215-247-0476.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? It's the spring membership drive, and as soon as we reach our goal, we will end this campaign. That is our pledge to you. We can only do it if you call 1-888-345-9499 or make a pledge online at WHYY.org. You're listening to Where Your Money Goes to support programs like Radio Times. We bring you regional, national, and international news and analysis and keep you informed about the important issues of the day. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We believe you're the kind of person who wants that kind of programming. So if you've never made a pledge or you have let your membership lapse, now is the time to take that next step and become a listener supporter. You'll be happy you did. Here's that phone number again. It's 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Again, you'll be very glad you did. Thanks so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. On Friday, the University of Delaware unveiled a small-scale project of 15 electric Mini Coopers that could make electric cars much more attractive. It's a two-way charging system that lets, say, an electric car both draw energy from the grid and feed energy back to the grid. The mastermind behind all of this is our third guest in this hour of Radio Times, Willett Kempton, professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment at the University of Delaware, also the research director of the Center for Carbon-Free Power Integration at the university. And Willett Kempton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Always pleased to be on your show.
Nice to have you on our show. And we're talking about these electric Mini Coopers that are essentially turned into a little mini power plant. Help us understand how this works.
Okay. Well, the cars are set up by the drivetrain manufacturer, the people who make the part that makes the electric motor go, so that they can either charge or discharge into the electric grid. Seems odd at first.
It
because
does.
You want to charge your car and you want to go, you don't want to discharge the car. And it's not used for normal driving, but it's extremely useful for what we want to do, which is supporting the stability of the electric grid.
And how would that work? And obviously, if you've got these cars discharging, that's giving energy back to the grid. How does it stabilize the grid?
Well, discharging doesn't do any good unless it's timed for exactly the needs of the grid operator. They're producing the electricity anyway. They don't need us to discharge back just at any random time. So how it stabilizes is that we get a signal from the regional grid operator, PJM Interconnection, which is providing the electricity that's blasting this broadcast out into the region and right, keeping my lights on here and so forth. It's about one-fifth of the United States. So PJM monitors whether they've got the right amount of electricity on a second-by-second basis. And they will say, they'll send us a signal, and many power plants that are doing this at the same time, not just us, and they'll say, for example, right now, we've got a little too much electricity. So some of those power plants will ramp down to a lower level. Our cars will start charging maybe as fast as they can. Maybe they're charging at a slow rate. The PJM tells us we got too much right now, so we respond by charging faster. And then maybe a few seconds later or a couple of minutes later, they'll say we're fine, we go back to zero. Then a little bit after that, oh, we don't have enough now, we'll discharge a bit.
And picking, I'm imagining being the owner of that particular car. For my sake, for my convenience, can I at any time go into my garage, unplug my car, and drive off knowing that I have the energy that it takes to power this vehicle?
Well, we give the driver two settings, and this is all being tested on drivers, so we may modify it a bit, but we've done it ourselves a lot and have been operating these vehicles for several years this way. So we give the driver two parameters. One is we say, tell us how long you might drive unexpectedly, like you're not going to give us any notice. This is all set by a web browser or your cell phone, of course. Tell us how much, you know, your sort of unexpected trip might be, and then tell us, you know, when you're going to take a longer trip. So maybe I drive to work and it's, you know, 30 miles round trip and there's no charger at work. Thus, 30 is kind of my normal. But maybe it's a 35-mile round trip to the emergency room and, hey, I want to be sure I got enough to do that.
Sure.
So I would set in 35 as my minimum number of miles ever. And then usually that's fine. You know, it covers my work trip and emergency. But, you know, tomorrow I'm going to go visit my cousin or something. So then it's a long way. So I put in 8 a.m. tomorrow, I want to be able to drive 100 miles.
Right.
So given that I've put in that information, which, you know, may only have to happen every few weeks when I take an unusually long trip after I've got the first part set up, as long as I put that in, what you said is correct. Yes, you're going to go out to the garage. You're always going to have the amount you need.
And obviously, we're talking about a smart grid that can essentially talk back and forth, I guess, between the power plant and this vehicle, which becomes a mini power plant.
It does become a mini power plant, but we're not necessarily talking about the smart grid. Everyone assumes that we need a smart grid to do this. And we'd love to have a smart grid, but, you know, it's a $1 trillion investment, and we're not going to pay for it. So, you know, while the electric sector is deciding, you know, when and how much and where and by what standards to put in the smart grid, we've built our own communication system for this.
And what's your vision then for Delaware and perhaps even beyond?
Well, to that, you know, when you buy an electric vehicle, you know, maybe half. If you want my vision, I don't have to say when it's going to happen, right?
No, you
at
don't.
Least half the, at least half the cars that you can buy that are electric have this little option, you know, for power plant services. And maybe there's a brochure at the dealer, or maybe the salesman gets a commission and tells you why it's a great idea. But you walk out of the dealership and you may decide I'm not interested, or you may say, I've signed up for this, I'll see what it's like. But as cars come into the market and are driven, we have more and more people providing this service. And it means, you know, the electrician that comes out and puts in your charging station does a few more adjustments and puts in a few codes. And it may mean an electrical inspection that you wouldn't do otherwise. And with those, which are pretty simple, you're participating.
And if I were a car owner and I did all of that, could I then make money off my car?
Yeah, the cars that we're using right now, which have several things that aren't optimized yet, are earning, as long as we keep them plugged in, they're earning about $5 a day.
Oh.
So that's $150 a month.
That's not bad.
It's a significant part of the cost of owning a vehicle.
So how long have you been working on this idea?
We published the first article in 1997.
Wow.
And at that time, I kind of had a typical academic's view that you do the research and you publish it, and then, you know, people see what a great idea is, rush out and do it. Turns out that you actually have to keep at it a little bit more than that.
So we're talking 15 plus years. I mean,
right.
You're laughing now, but yes, I'm sure there
it's
was
a long haul, but it's fun. You know, it's always more fun to do something that's sort of new and creative when at least half of the experts in the field tell you that it's impossible. That just, you know, makes it all the more fun to do it.
Well, and I was reading about your press conference on Friday. The governor was there. I mean, this was a pretty big deal for Delaware.
Well, you know, I hate to sound egotistical, but I think it's a pretty big deal for the electric system. It's not just Delaware.
Because of this unique, I guess, design feature, obviously, and the idea of it really gets us thinking differently about what an automobile can be and can do.
I think that's a great description of it. I mean, when I got my first cell phone, I thought it was just a cell phone. And now I think that I maybe had an appointment planner in the, you know, in another pocket, or I had an address book, you know, it was paper. Now that I think of those things, it's all the same device. So. Mm-hmm. You know, my car certainly has been just a transportation device, and when it sits in the driveway, it's not doing anything. It's just getting in the way of, you know, the lawnmower or pulling the trash cans out. But now you're thinking of your car as a revenue generator.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to hear what our listeners have to say. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Willett Kempton, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about electric vehicles. And he's a professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment at the University of Delaware, where he's also the research director of the Center for Carbon-Free Power Integration conversation. We are talking about a small project with big plans that was unveiled on Friday, having to do with thinking about our cars as a mini power plant. And we're taking calls again, as I said, at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what John from Trenton has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. Marty, thank you for the invitation call in.
Sure.
I have two real quick issues. The first is I'm just wondering, nothing lasts forever, and I'm just wondering whether they know environmentally how they will be able to dispose of these batteries once they finally give out. And the second issue is that I am blind, and these quiet electric cars are extremely dangerous to the blindness community. We obviously can't see the cars, and so if we can also not hear them in intersections, it's extremely dangerous and life-threatening to us. So we do have passed that by 2017, all electric cars are going to have to make some kind of noise in order for the blindness community to be able to safely cross the street. I thank you very much for the invitation
sure,
to call
John.
In.
No, well, thank you for calling in to Radio Times. Two interesting points. Willard, if we can take the quietness of some of these cars, is it a risk for people like John who are blind?
These are two areas that I'm not an expert in either of them, so I would just give you a sort of layman's response without any background. So I guess I'll decline to answer those. I mean, I've heard both those discussed, but I'm not any more knowledgeable about them than anyone else.
Fair enough. And I always appreciate it when a guest says, I don't know something, rather than speculating. It's actually quite refreshing. Well, let's see what Suzanne from Westchester has to say. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment. You know, I think your listening audience is pretty much Pennsylvania, and we know how bad the roads are here. I just have a comment about the safety of some of these smart cars. Believe me, I'm all for finding ways to save money and conserve energy, but it just scares me to death to put my soon-to-be driving, you know, children in these little teeny cars. There are no shoulders on some of these roads, and they're ill-maintained. Yeah.
Well, and just so you know, Suzanne, we're not really just talking just about small cars, although this project is involved with the Mini Cooper, and those are small cars. But let me see if Willett Kempton has any comments to your question. Any thoughts, Willett?
Well, sure. I mean, there's no real relationship between electric and small, and your show today is on electric cars.
Right.
So, yes, we have a fleet of electric cars which are small, and, you know, we also have large electric cars, and you know, there's this tractor trailer, you know, that's as big as any kind of highway crusher you've ever seen that's all electric. There's a couple of those in California. So there's no relationship with size. A gasoline car, I would say, is actually a good bit more dangerous than an electric car. You're carrying, you know, 10 gallons of highly combustible fuel, and if the car is in a crash, that pours out on the pavement and can start a big fire. We have a lot of deaths per year from gasoline vehicle fire. So I don't think an electric vehicle is more dangerous. I think it's more safe.
Suzanne, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Will Kempton, even looking ahead then, I mean, you've unveiled this project. What will you be looking for as it evolves?
Well, we'd like to see more automakers sign up. We're working with BMW now. There's a couple of others that don't want their names used yet. So we'd like to, you know, see more cars that have the capability, and then we just snap a little control module in and start the operation. Whereas now we're having to do retrofits on each car, which is a bit more expensive, and that doesn't make it so accessible to the general public. So that's kind of my first thing I'd like to see. What we'll be doing in our own research group, we've had the stationary vehicles running. We're starting to have more moving vehicles outside of our own research group. So we'll be getting the kind of consumer reaction to the car, which is then having the second function when it's parked. Your previous guest, Tom Turrentine, has done really great, you know, probably the best work anywhere on how people use and think about electric vehicles. But what we don't know is how they think about that as something that's also,
sure,
you know, providing service when it's parked. And do they remember to plug it in? You know, we want them to plug in all the time they're stationary, not just when they need a charge. And, you know, does it affect, you know, do they forget? You know, I said you have to tell us if you're going to take a long trip. And tell us means you pull out your mobile app and you say, 100 miles tomorrow morning. But do they forget? And then what happens? You know, so there's a lot of those kind of questions that we'll be answering with the driving vehicles with non-researchers over the next year.
And that's Willett Kempton, our guest today on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Frank from Honeybrook, Pennsylvania to join us. And Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. I was curious if, to find out if these cars, say I had it parked in my garage and we had a snowstorm or a storm and the grid went out, could I use it? Would it be enough to power the house in an emergency for a day or two?
Well, that's an interesting question. Have you gotten that far, Willett?
Yeah, we have developed all the design of that. There's a couple of safety things that we would need to go through certifications, but we can do that now. You can't power it up and stay connected to the grid because there's a risk to the people who work on those power lines.
Oh.
That we have to be absolutely sure of and get various certifications and so forth, which are totally is supportive of the paperwork that's needed because it is a definite hazard to line workers. But, my average U.S. house uses about a kilowatt or a kilowatt and a half. Our batteries and the vehicles we're using now have about 34 kilowatt hours, so we could actually run a day or a day and a half, just as you suggested.
Thank you for the call to Radio Times. And Willett Kempton, we're nearly out of time here. And going back to 1997, as you said, this is when this idea, I guess, began to at least blossom. Was it a matter of just getting money for this thing or just the technology, the time that it takes to develop the technology?
Both. Yeah. And, of course, you can do more development when you've got more resources. You know, we get research grants. They pay our costs. You know, we don't make money on research grants. They go into people who do work, you know. So I can move faster when I have some support. I can sort of sit in my office and think and maybe recruit a student to work on something without. So we started getting a more significant amount of money around 2006 from Google, Pepco Holdings. We're now U.S. Department of Energy, the state of Delaware, and we're now supported by NRG Energy, which is a generator. So all that means we can move much faster, and there's, 60,000 lines of code, a bunch of custom designed circuit boards, new protocols that nobody's using before.
And we got to say goodbye.
We've done a lot with support.
I congratulate you on this very interesting project. Willett Kempton, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. This show produced by Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.